Hello and welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today we will be talking about the new movie Avatar: Way of the Water. Hello and welcome to History in Reverse. My name is Caroline and I'm here with my father, Richie.
Hello.
And we just saw the best movie ever, Avatar: Way of the Water.
So this is emergency podcast unscheduled about to discuss this particular movie.
Yes, that we loved so much. It was so good. All the critics
have to be so sarcastic to begin with.
All the critics are saying how good it is, isn't it? So it's an amazing feat, James Cameron's most amazing feat that needed 13 years. To be produced. So actually, I mean, I think this one thing we should start with is this is a sequel to a movie that was made 13 years ago. And the first Avatar, you saw the first Avatar when it came out, right?
Yeah, of course.
I loved it when it first came out. I was really into it. It was very cutting edge for its time, like for the year. It was like 2010.
Well, do we want to just briefly review the plot of the original one? I mean, or just the basic
idea. Yeah, but I just want to like posit this in like in terms of like the first one was kind of this like breakout movie. It was like very popular, like very intensely watched and talked about, and then it kind of fell off the face of the earth, and for 13 years no one really talked about it. And there was always these kind of whisperings like, oh, there's going to be a whole series of them, but like nobody was really into it. And I think one thing we should talk about maybe at the end of our podcast when we're done recapping and sort of analyzing it is, was it worth it to do this movie, the second one, 13 years later? And apparently there's like 5 of them planned. So there's some like insane number.
I don't know.
Yeah. So, and James Cameron said in like an interview that he waited until now to do the movie because he was waiting for the technology to catch up to be able to do what he wanted. There was nothing in this movie that couldn't have been done 5-6 years ago.
No, I think some of the visual stuff, the underwater scenes, probably required more computer power than was available 10 years ago.
So. I don't think so, because there are video games from like the early
2000s
that have really good water graphics.
To produce a movie, you require a lot more computer power, and it's probably, maybe it existed, but it's probably too expensive. So now you can do it on your iPhone.
Yeah, I don't know. I think back in when the first movie came out, sure, maybe it wasn't there yet, but it was certainly there 5 years ago. We've had, you know, movies with great CGI coming out for a long time. But anyway, so yeah, you want to talk about the most miraculous plot?
Well, let's just review the setting, right? So Avatar. So first of all, the name Avatar refers to this science fiction idea that was in the first movie where the humans arrived on this planet named Pandora. I don't know why they picked that
name. That's such a weirdly on-the-nose name. Strange.
Why? It's very negative.
Well, because it's Pandora, like Pandora's box. Like, you don't want
to... Yeah. Pandora's box was basically released all the suffering on the humans. So, I mean, there's...
Well, I think I think that's one thing, is that Pandora, the planet, is very dangerous for humans, which is why they need the avatars, as you're saying.
Right, so the idea was with the avatars was that human kind of climbed into this little coffin and connected electronically to basically a person of the local race. What are they called? The Na'vi?
The Na'vi, yeah. Right,
which are kind of big, tall blue people. Mm-hmm. And then basically you kind of remotely operated this avatar, and that's how you interacted with the people. And there was, you know, there was a group of scientists who were studying them, and there was also the bad corporate guys who wanted to exploit the planet. Mm-hmm. Because in the first movie they wanted to get the unobtainium.
They wanted to get the unobtainium, and it seemed that in the first movie there was an implication that this magical mineral unobtainium was created by the fact that Pandora has this interconnectedness. So like all the plants and animals on Pandora seem to be connected, sort of like a brain. And like the biggest concentration of unobtainium was under the most like important tree that everybody connects to for the Na'vi. And that therefore they led to the destruction of the tree. And did you know that deforestation is bad? Let us show it to you on screen for 25 minutes, and now you'll know. In this movie, you're going to learn that whaling is bad.
So the Na'vi in the original movie were able to, they had these flying dragon thingies that they could ride on and stuff, and they would fight against the bad guys. In the end, they won.
Yeah. So they have a really cool science fiction concept, which they use in this one too, where the Na'vi have these like long, like a one single long tendril out of the back of their head that has like nerve endings. And so they can pretty much plug in to whatever, like they could plug into like
other animals.
Yeah. Yeah. They could, and they perform like a neural bond. It's sort of the expansion of the fact that Pandora is all interconnected as sort of one mind. And they can, like, upload their memories to the magical trees, and they have this, you know, get it, everyone's connected. It's very deep and meaningful. And that was a cool science fiction concept. I like that a lot. And
right. And in the end of one of the characters in the original movie was this guy named Jake Sully, who was a Marine who had lost his legs or something. And only when he was an Avatar, he was, like, fully hitting all his legs, and he could jump around and move and whatever. And at the end of the movie, something magical happens where Jake basically becomes a Na'vi.
Yeah, so Jake becomes, they use the magical tree connection to transfer Jake's mind from his human soul body to his Avatar body. So the last shot of the first movie is him waking up as his Avatar.
As a Na'vi. No longer an Avatar.
Right. Which is, like, at the time was, like, really super, like, a super cool concept, and I liked that as a science fiction thing. I don't think it's aged particularly well.
Oh, come on. There's all kinds of ideas about transferring minds between things.
I know.
You haven't seen The Fly, have you?
No, I know, and this is probably too long of a conversation for the context of this podcast, but there's something not great about someone from the, like, invading force, like, coming in and, like, literally becoming native. Like it's like a bad version of that trope, and it's just not great. It doesn't feel great when you decide to make your quote unquote native population of this planet be basically Native Americans. Then you get into like these weird implications that they're not good. It's also kind of basic. It's like, oh, we're gonna make natives. What are they gonna? They're gonna have bows and arrows. Like what? They're on a planet somewhere out in the galaxy. They're going to have bows and arrows. Okay.
Well, they fly on these dragons. The other thing that was weird about Pandora, they had these mountains that were just floating in the air.
Mm-hmm. Which, the Hallelujah Mountains, weird. Yeah. That was cool. The thing about the Avatar universe is it has a lot of really interesting creative concepts. And well, unfortunately, they kind of hoist those creative concepts onto narrative arcs that are just not satisfying. And are especially not satisfying in this movie.
In the Avatar universe, in this movie and the previous one, was visually very striking. Mm-hmm. Right? Because the people are kind of interesting blue people, kind of.
Sexy blue people. Yeah, we all love our sexy blue
people.
Sexy
blue people. Yeah. Yep. And the animals that would have lights at night, and it's all these kind of cool things.
Yeah, a lot of bioluminescent stuff. Yeah, it was super cool. Yeah, I think the strongest thing for it has always been the visuals. And that continues in this movie. Again, it's like, you have these, like, tons of money dumped into this visual stuff, obviously. Some creative thought into these, like, little concepts throughout. But then just, like, they went to, like, the generic story store and, like, rattled around in the bargain bin and pulled out, like, you know, oh, the first one's gonna be Pocahontas in space. Got it. You know, the second one's gonna be every story you ever want all at once, but none of them are interesting. Here you go.
Right. So one of the things, we'll talk about the plot of this new movie, and don't worry about spoilers because the movie is quite predictable.
At no point in time was I surprised.
So the last movie ends when Jake becomes a real Na'vi, and this movie begins with a short history of his family, right? So he gets married to this Na'vi woman.
Neytiri.
She is really good with the bow.
Yeah, so Neytiri's in the first movie. And she's played by Zoe Saldana. I'm assuming Zoe Saldana reprised her role for the second one. She's a main character in the first movie. She has, like, half the speaking lines. She's in almost, like, she's a main character. She's not just a love interest, which is nice. In this movie, she's terribly sidelined. I'm not even sure they say her name in this movie.
Yeah, I didn't remember her name.
I didn't remember either. I don't think it's in dialogue. I don't think it's in dialogue in this movie. I mean, she like has almost, I could probably write her all of her lines of dialogue on one page. Like she's, and I don't know if that was like a scheduling thing with like the actor, or I have a feeling it was more a story thing because I'm sure she would have come back to do this role. But oh, now I'm questioning myself. Was it Zoe Saldana who played her? Wait, now I need to know because now I'm not sure. Who plays, sorry, this is really good radio. In Avatar. Yeah, in the first one, it's Zoe Saldana. Is it different? Oh, it might be different. No, it is Zoe Saldana still. Okay. Okay, I was right. I'm sorry. I just needed to. We're committed to accuracy on History in Reverse. So anyway,
the movie begins with kind of short history of Jake and his family. When the movie really begins, he has four children. Mm-hmm. Well, three children and one adopted child.
Yes.
Right. So the three children are two sons. There's an like, old son, younger son, and a young daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And reading some descriptions, I said this movie begins 10 years later. But it seems to be longer because, you know, the oldest son was more than 10.
I mean, do we know if they age the same rate as humans? Or I mean, we don't know.
I suppose.
Yeah, we don't know how long they age. The fact that they made his avatar, like, able to sexually reproduce is interesting. Like, why would they do that when they made his avatar? But okay. But the one interesting child in the off the bat is the magical destiny child, Kiri.
So Kiri,
in the first movie, there were several humans that used avatars. Jake was one of them, and he ultimately transfers into his avatar. There's another scientist who is played by that actor. What's her name?
Sigourney Weaver.
I don't know what the character's name.
The character name was Grace Augustine. Dr. Grace Augustine.
Yes, Dr. Grace Augustine. So Dr. Grace Augustine dies in the first one. They try to save her by transferring her into her avatar, but it doesn't work. And she just kind of goes into the tree. But her avatar is maintained in its, like, pod in, like, the station for some reason. They just, like, kept a hold of it. And it randomly on its own gets pregnant, which is weird. And some people have said, like, that's, like, a little disturbing. And it's like, they could be. I could see that. But I think the implication is, like, some kind of the magic of the planet somehow led to this, you know, Jesus child being born from the body of the avatar that has no consciousness. Oh, the other thing we should mention is that the Na'vi refer to the sort of power of the planet as Awa, which is a really simple play on Yahweh, which is the old word for God. So it's Awa. It's easy to remember. So Kiri is kind of interesting off the bat because she seems to have like an extra special connection to Pandora and to Awa and that kind of stuff.
And Jake and Niyatri adopted her.
Right. And everything is going great. They're having a good time. It's like a monologue in the beginning about happiness or something.
But then, you know, the people coming for Unobtainium, still trying to get Unobtainium, so there's like a resistance movement led by Jake.
Right. Well, so the humans come back. There's like a period of time where the humans aren't there, yada, yada, and then boom, they're back. They start building bases. They build like a whole city. There's like a, we get like one shot of a city. And it trains. And like they're doing all this stuff on Pandora. They're deforesting. Again, deforestation is bad. And Jake is leading this like resistance movement. The Na'vi are getting like guns. And he's using his military training, his marine training to sort of lead these things.
But what I noticed several times in the movie that Neytiri is really good with a bow and arrow. And like she can shoot a bow, an arrow through like a window of one of all those airplanes that they fly there. And it's like, you think by now, after a couple of times, they would realize they would put some stronger glass.
Right. Because in the first movie, that's how they did it. That all the Na'vi were shooting through the windows to shoot the pilots out. I mean, you'd think in the first movie that maybe they would have done something to help the army, the Marine veteran who can't walk, be able to walk again. I don't know if you remember in the very first movie, Jake's explanation for why he can't walk is that he was injured, but that his benefits wouldn't pay for the surgery to cure him. That's the explanation.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah. It's a one-liner in the beginning, and he's like, yeah, they have surgeries that can help fix you, but that's not covered on VA benefits. I'm like, what are you talking about? Come up with a better explanation. See, there's things about these movies that it's like, I feel like they are the first draft. Like, somebody wrote it, nobody proofread it, and they said, film it. This movie, Avatar: Way of the Water, is very much that vibe. Very much that vibe.
So, anyway, I guess the enemy in Avatar 1 was this Marine general or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever, I don't know what his rank was. And he gets killed.
Mm-hmm. Right. But then...
But then...
He comes back! Dun, dun, dun!
He was backed up. His conscience or soul was backed up.
Mm-hmm.
And they put him into a Navi body, an avatar. Without...
dun,
so
dun,
he comes
dun.
Back with a squad of his buddies, all mm-hmm. as Navi, and he's out for revenge.
And like obviously the humans want to stop Jake because he's leading these resistance things and like ruining their trains and stuff. But obviously, Marine guy, he wants to stop him for that reason, but also to get revenge because he knows that Jake had something to do with his death. And you'd think that like discovering how he died and like the reason for his death might be like a movie long plot of like growth and experience and learning, but it's not. It's not. Actually, he says, "I wonder how I died," and the next scene he finds out. So straightforward. He finds his body and he says, "Oh, I got shot." Okay.
And then there was this other character, Spider.
I was so confused by Spider. I didn't understand where he came from.
All right. So apparently, at the time when the humans had to leave, or the military had to leave, Spider was born. He was too little to be frozen for the space travel or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So they left him. Mm-hmm. And whatever this small group of scientists remained, he remained on the planet.
But he was the general's son.
Well, right. I forget who the mother was supposed to
be. I don't think we know. I don't think that was in the first movie. That was, right,
So we have one daughter who was born without a father.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a son that was born without a mother.
Well, presumably he had a mother. We just don't know who it was.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this kid basically kind of is buddies with the four kids of Jake's. Jake mm-hmm. and Neytiri. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And he runs around. You know, he kind of understands Navi ways, even though he's not an avatar. He's a human. So he mm-hmm. runs around with this mask because humans cannot breathe the air.
And you'd think that would come up as a plot point sometime during this movie, that humans cannot breathe the air and maybe Spider would be in danger. But guess what doesn't happen? That.
Well, he has his mask on all the time, so.
You'd think it's like Chekhov's gun, but nobody ever goes back and picks it up. I don't know. There's interesting detail with the general. When the general finds his own body, he finds that, like you were discussing, with the arrows being shot through, Neytiri shooting the arrows through the window into their machines and killing them. That's how he died. Neytiri had killed him.
Right. Neytiri killed.
So he finds her arrow in his like skeleton. And then throughout the movie, and this was a nice touch, throughout the movie, every time she's around and she's shooting arrows nearby, whenever he sees one of them, like they get stuck in a wall or something, and he looks at it and sees the fletching is like her arrow fletching, he like pauses and has like a panic, and has like a like he's hesitant, and it's like it's a very interesting characterization of him. It's about the only characterization of him, but it's an interesting little detail that they bring up. It comes up a couple times. It's good visual storytelling.
So anyway, when they get down, this crew of his name is Miles Quidditch.
That's the general guy?
Yeah, that's his name. But I mean, I don't know if they ever used it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe once or twice. People call him Colonel or something.
Yeah, I think it's Colonel.
Anyway,
maybe it's Colonel.
They go to like the old building where he was killed, and the four kids who are romping around the woods see them.
Oh no! What serendipity! Of all the gin joints, all the woods you could be at. Oh no! And what happens?
They try to kill them. There's some little fight. Jake and his wife have to rescue the kids, but they capture the little mm-hmm. monkey guy. Somehow, the colonel realizes that's his son. Is it at that point or is it later?
Yeah, it is somehow. I don't know. He has like a moment of recognition or something. I don't know. He recognizes him. But yeah, it's like, oh no, they get captured and then they get freed. Oh no, would they be captured for the movie and part of the movie would be trying to get the kid? Nope. They get freed immediately. Great. First draft.
Well, so they do capture a Spider, the human kid, and they try to get him to explain, like, you know, tell them what to find Jake, and they have some hiding places in various places in these floating mountains.
Right, and it was at this point in time in the movie that I was like, okay, I know what's going to happen. And I'm not against this kind of plot, but I know what's going to happen. Spider and the Colonel are going to, you know, the Colonel's going to force Spider to help them learn things about the Navi and learn things about Pandora. And through the process of learning these things and trying to find ways to overcome Jake, the Colonel and his crew are going to come, they're also going to become true Navi and come to love Pandora and understand the great connection amongst everything. And he and Spider are going to bond as father and son. And at the end, they're not going to have to fight because they're going to become native as well. That's not what happens. That's not what happens. It would have been beautiful. I would have loved it. And the whole concept of, like, we're all connected and this great connection between all of us is so important and so magical and vital and powerful could have overcome this, like, desire for mild revenge or unobtainium or whale brains or whatever it is you're looking for. But we don't do that instead. We don't. We never get
so there. Meanwhile, while the Colonel is interrogating Spider, Jake comes back and realizes what's going on, and he says, they're going to destroy all of us, so they're really after me and my family, so we're just going to leave. We're going to go into exile. Mm-hmm. So they pack everything up, jump on a couple of these flying dragons, mm-hmm. and off they go.
And what's interesting is that the way that the bad avatars, the human avatars that are trying to kill Jake, the way they figured out that Jake has kids is that Jake's avatar has five fingers. All the other Navi have four fingers total. And all of Jake's kids have five fingers. So they're identifiable. And other Navi call them half-breeds. So they're identifiable as being mixed between a natural Navi and an avatar.
See, I never realized that until much later that the Navi had four fingers and the mm-hmm. humans had five.
Yeah, it was because all the creatures on Pandora have like four limbs. Like the dragons have like four wings. The horses have, they have four or six. So like the dragons have four front wings and then two back legs. The horses have four front legs and two back legs. They all have that, except okay. the Navi who just have the two arms and two legs, but then their hands are four. So I don't know. Yeah, it's a good detail. It's a good consistent world building kind of detail.
Right.
That's cool. Even though the story's bad. So yeah, so then they flee
across the ocean. And
there's a couple of moments in this movie where the writing, they use this one character, the youngest daughter, Took, the little girl. Mm-hmm. They use her for like comic relief, which is fine. She's like a kid, whatever. But there's times when I'm like, where am I? Like, what movie am I watching? Because you'll have dialogue from some of them that's like so serious and so like on point for like what the Navi are like, and then you have like Took on the back of this dragon holding onto her mom, and she goes, are we there yet? And it's like, that's cute, but where am I? I'm on Pandora. I'm not in the United States, you know? And there's lots of dialogue with that, especially with the teenage boys. It gets really wonky with how they speak.
Well, it's like the movie's trying to have some characters for each generation. So there's like the little kid, there's the teenagers, and then the adults, right?
But dialogue-wise, it makes sense for Jake to speak like a human because I understand it's like all, technically they're all speaking Navi, right? But
right.
you're translating that dialogue into English for your primarily Western audience, right? So it makes sense for Jake to speak like we do, like here on Earth. But then you have like Neytiri and all the other adult Navi who speak in like a different cadence of sentence, like their sentences are different and they have an accent. And then you take the kids, the oldest son of the children has an accent and speaks in the cadence like Neytiri. The second son is saying like dude and bro the whole movie. Then you have Kiri, the one with the magical destiny, who also is like, she at one point in time Kiri calls somebody a perv. Where am I? Where it's Pandora. And then you have Took, who's like just comic relief and is like, I can't believe I was captured again. The dialogue writing is like so all over the place. It's really distracting. And it's really world-breaking because it's like, how do the Navi speak? These children are born on Pandora. They might pick up some phrases from their dad. And like that could be funny if they're like in the middle of their regular speech and then they use some word that dad uses or some phrase that dad uses, but overwhelmingly they're going to sound like Neytiri and the other Na'vi around them, because this is Pandora. This is not the United States. So it was very strange. Again, this is why I'm saying first draft. They wrote it, they said, sounds good, and then they produced it. That was it. Anyway, thank you for coming to my little rant.
Anyway, so they go across the sea and they land on some island where there's another settlement of the Na'vi, mm-hmm. who live clearly like in the water, kind of like Polynesia kind of a settlement.
Mm-hmm. And it's cool.
The water must be pretty warm because they can hop into them. When they first arrived, there's this whole thing where they, the two chiefs and the two women.
I don't even know how to, listen, this movie's like 3 hours long. It's more than that. It's like 3 hours and 15 or something. And it's like they went to, I've told you a little bit about TVTropes.com. For anyone listening, TVTropes.com. It's just a collection of different tropes that you see in storytelling. And tropes aren't necessarily bad. There's just that there are patterns that humans use in storytelling, and that's fine. It happens. Some of them are bad, though. And it's like they went to the TVTropes.com and, like, printed them out and cut them out and put them in a bucket and reached in and pulled out, like, a handful and said, we're going to do all of these. We're going to do all of these in every scene as much as possible. And the way they write women in this story boggles my mind. It's like they said, how can we make it simultaneously as basic as possible and also as sexist as possible? Let's see how we can do that together. I know. When the chieftain's wives meet, when the wives meet each other, both of whom are mothers, the one of them is pregnant at the time, the one of the water tribe chief. Who knows what her name is? We don't know. We're never told those things. We don't get names.
Rona.
There you go. We get it from Wikipedia. Yeah. When these two women meet, two women who have children, who are of different tribes but are of the same race, who know that the world is being invaded by these outsiders, and Neytiri is coming with her four kids and saying, we are being hunted down, we need to hide, we basically need asylum. When these two women meet, they're going to fight. Because that's what women do. When you put two women who have some kind of power next to each other, they can't possibly get along. They have to fight each other. It's a trope called women are always catty. It's very prevalent in fantasy and science fiction. And they took it so far to the extent that, like, the Na'vi actually they literally hiss at each other. It's like something they do when they're mad.
Right.
But they have two women who are meet each other, are immediately antagonistic for no reason. No reason. Neytiri is not a threat to them. They're not a threat to Neytiri. There's no reason to be antagonistic. Immediately antagonistic and literally hissing at each other. Like, it's literally all women are catty. And I was, like, watching it on my screen. Like, did no one take James Cameron to the side and be like, bud, maybe think about this more. Maybe just think about it. Because what's the what ultimately happens? They have this confrontation and then what?
And it's okay, you can stay.
And then it's okay, they can stay! Why did they have to fight? And what does that antagonistic relationship ever
we'll
amount to?
We'll teach you our ways.
But what does that antagonistic relationship ever amount to in the story?
Nothing.
Nothing ever happens. It's not even like they start out to be enemies and become friends. It just never goes anywhere. They're just antagonistic because that's all the writers could think. All they could think is two powerful women who meet each other must be antagonistic. It's so insanely basic. I was just like losing my mind when I was watching this. I was like wanting to write notes in my phone while I was watching this movie. But yeah, so they get to stay. Surprise.
They get to stay, and then there's a bit of a honeymoon period where they learn the ways of the water people, where they have to ride
the
water animals
scene.
Of various
Wait,
kinds.
The next scene right after the moms are antagonistic with each other is that we get introduced to our love interest of the story, whose name I also don't know, who's the teenage girl, the scantily clad, sexy blue teenage girl of the water people. And she, do you remember when she comes out of the water?
Vaguely.
She walks out of the water and like flips her hair and has like the water dripping down her. And the teenage boys are like ogling her. And I'm like, are we seriously doing this right now? I'm like, where am I? Is this Baywatch? I don't understand.
Well, maybe they expect boys and dads to come to see this movie, not dads and daughters.
But still, it's so basic. It's like, oh, you have a sexy blue alien? Oh, is it in water? Oh, no, it's a sexy blue water alien. Like, come on. You have so much to work with, and you just don't. You just don't. So, yeah, so then the story actually gets kind of interesting because it becomes about the kids more so.
Well, right. So, I mean, they're this honeymoon period, they learn how to breathe underwater, you know, so they can stay underwater for quite a long time. And they learn to ride underwater dragons, whatever, which kind of correspond to the flying dragons. Mm-hmm. And
what's interesting about this scene, or this is like a montage of scenes where they're like learning these things. We see all four children learning skills. We see Jake learning skills. We do not see Neytiri learning anything. Neytiri is not shown during that montage. And I was very mad about that. She's got to learn it too. Like
she was pretty good, yeah.
Yeah. We don't get to see her learning to tame one of the underwater dragons. We don't get to see her learning how to use her hunting skills here. We don't get to see anything about how she folds into the society. She's just not on screen. And then there's a scene.
Some teenage drama, right? Mm-hmm. The local boys and the new boys kind of fighting each other and getting in trouble.
Because that's also what teenagers do. All teenagers just pick on each other all the time. They're just bullies constantly.
And basically one of the second youngest son, the second son winds up having a pet whale.
Yeah, shenanigans ensue. And listen, I thought I was going to be a lot more afraid of this movie than I was because I'm very terrified of underwater creatures. And I didn't like it when it opened its mouth very big. I didn't look at the screen for that. But otherwise, the underwater creatures weren't that frightening.
Yeah, the whale reminded me a little bit of the worms on Dune, right?
Yeah, it was a little bit of... And it reminded me of something else. Gosh, oh, I'll have to go back and think. There was something else from another video game. The mouth being kind of triangle-shaped is like a pretty common shape in mythical creature mouths. I don't know how else to describe it. So, the second son ends up... the dude bro son ends up dude broing it with a magical whale. And...
Basically, it pulls out a harpoon out of its fin, and that.
There's this bizarre plot here, where, like, he like befriends this whale, and the whale's missing a particular fin. So when he gets home, he's like, "Yo, I was saved by this whale, and this looked like he was missing this fin." And everyone's like, "Oh, you cannot touch that whale. He's exiled or something." What is it that they say?
Right, he didn't have a pair or something.
Like
all the whales come in pairs. You know, they're paired up.
Right, well, they're like, he's exiled because that whale is like a bad whale. He's a killer. Like, he kills, and the whales are all peaceful except for this particular whale is not peaceful. You can't be friends with that whale. And the teenage boy's like, "He's different. You don't understand. He's bro. He saved my life." And then that plot ends up becoming that he eventually bonds with the whale, which requires him to be swallowed by the whale.
Right, so in order
and he
to plug
connects
in
the, to it.
His connection, his
yeah, he uses
to the
his,
whale.
Uses his USB port and connects to the whale and sees the whale's memory. And wouldn't you know, it's the most straightforward thing ever. The whale was not the one responsible for the destruction that everyone thinks it was. It was really the humans. Oh no.
Sky
I could
people.
Have never seen that coming.
They actually hunt the whales.
They hunt the whales? Are you telling me that whaling is bad? What? I am shocked. But wait. While the whale thing is happening, we get a couple of scenes scattered here and there of Spider and the Colonel. And this is where I thought we were going to do something of them bonding or him like connecting to Pandora. But no, you know what we have instead? We have the Colonel as a Navi taming his own flying dragon thing in a scene that is literally almost identical to the scene from the first one when Jake tames his dragon. It's like, why did you show it to me if you were going to just copy and paste it? It's literally the same thing. Jake does the same thing in the first movie. He gets on the dragon, it jumps over the cliff. Everyone's like, oh no, he died. And then, whoop, he pops back up. He didn't die. He connected with it. Woo! It's first draft! Why? Why? It was like a 7-minute scene. It was long. Maybe it was a full 7 minutes. It was like a 5-minute scene.
Yeah, I mean, because he was going to shoot the dragon and with some, you know, some drugs to Tom Tamet and and Spider says, "Oh, the Navi can do it by, you know, without any drugs." Ha ha ha. He says, "All right, I can do it too."
Yeah, and then wouldn't you know, he does it too. And that's it.
Surprise, surprise.
So, I'm shocked.
So how do they find out that Jake is where he is? Something happened.
Our magical destiny child has a little touch of her magical destiny happens in this movie, and I was almost interested in it, and then they ruined it. So Kiri is like feeling AWA all the time. She's like we get lots of shots of her doing shit, like she goes deep into the ocean and like has like glowing fish around her and they're like swirling. And she's like touching plants and they're like reacting to her and she's like, "Ooh, I'm magic," right? So they bring her to the magic underwater tree.
The sacred place, right?
Yeah.
The underwater tree. Right?
The magic underwater tree, exactly. And they're like, "Come check out our magic underwater tree. You're gonna love this." And so they all connect with the little USB ports. And she has a really extreme reaction. And this is when she has her dream. And this is the one scene that lets this movie pass the Bechdel test. So she has this vision where she talks to her mom, Dr. Augustine, you said? Yeah.
Grace Augustine.
Grace Augustine. She has a vision where she talks to her mom. And they share a few lines of dialogue. And then what's happening in real life is that Kiri's having a seizure underwater. And that's really dangerous because she's, like, drowning. And then they bring her back to the village. And that's when Jake calls the scientists, like the human scientists that are still on Pandora, to come and help Kiri and try to have her regain consciousness. And you might think, wow, magical unconsciousness. This sounds like a plot point that's going to like lead to some kind of narrative arc and going to be something difficult that they have to overcome. And the answer is no, it's not. She wakes up.
Well, no, but the scientists, whatever it is they do, doesn't work.
We don't really know because they're like doing stuff and then they get shooed away by the chieftain's wife.
The mother and the chieftain's wife. And the chieftain's wife does some magical pounding on her back.
Yeah, she like pokes her and then she wakes up. So it's like, did she wake up from the poking or did she just wake up? Or did she wake up from what the scientists were doing? I don't know. Like, it's not really clear. It's not, they don't do like magic. They do like, I'm touching you with herbs magic. So.
But the scientists flew down there in the machine, right? So I guess that's how they got tracked.
Right, exactly.
So then the colonel basically gets a ship going saying, "Oh, we're going to go there and see if we can find him." And says, and the guy whose ship they're using it's a whaling ship, right? So he says, "I have quotas, you know.
Oh, I have capitalism still. I need to do my capitalism. What are you doing? You're interrupting my capitalism in the future. Oh man, it's bad to be a capitalist these days with the military commandeering my ship." Yeah.
So anyway, so they go down on the ship, and on the way that they have a whale hunt.
This is when it becomes Moby Dick for like 25 minutes, yeah?
Right.
Oh, and it's so depressing. They're like, "We're gonna hunt the whale. We're gonna target the mother in the pack of whales because she has a new calf and she won't swim away fast because she has the calf." Then they kill the mom in front of the calf, and the calf is like, "Mom!" And then they go inside the whale, and what do they harvest?
They harvest some brain juice, some magic brain juice, about, you know, like two glasses of it or something. Mm-hmm. And saying, "This is the most desirable substance in the universe." Mm-hmm. You know, this thing is worth, you know, quantillion something or others.
Mm-hmm. Because it stops human aging. Yeah. So I want to let everybody know, we are a solid hour and 45 minutes into the movie before this comes up.
That's right.
So, like, the reason for the humans being there and still doing stuff like this is not mentioned for an hour and 45 minutes. And then you'd think this was a really important plot point that would lead to some kind of narrative arc and get you somewhere.
I'm detecting a pattern.
you'd think this would get you somewhere, but it never comes up again. This is it. You get one scene an hour and 45 minutes in, and then nobody ever talks about it again.
Well, but they had to show you all the whaling technology, right? They had the boats with the harpoons, the submarines. Mm-hmm. The submarines or something else. They were like surface boats and submarines.
Yeah.
And a big boat.
I mean, they had a pretty neat operation there. I mean, it was pretty effective. But I mean, one of the things too about these whales that we learn, I think just before the whale hunt, just to make it sadder, mm-hmm. is that these whales have like a spiritual connection with the water Na'vi, and they all have they do this migration where they come back like every year to like visit, and they can communicate. The Na'vi and these whales can speak. And then we learn during the harvesting of the whale brain portion that these whales are not only highly intelligent, I wonder where they got that from, but they're probably more intelligent than the humanoid species, than both the Na'vi and the humans. Like, their brains are much more advanced. So it's also this just, like, there's this, like, theme in the Avatar movies thus far, and I assume it's going to continue, which is just this, like, disregard for the, not only just the sanctity of life, but, like, the sanctity of, like, intelligent life by your, like, future human capitalists. And I don't know if that's, like, to a point. You know, I guess the point is greed is bad. I mean, it's very basic. It's very, this is like an eighth grade book report, you know. It's very straightforward. You know, it's like, when, what was the book that we covered that had kind of easy, 1984 has like a bunch of like easy eighth grade book report kind of themes. But then it has this like layer of like a meta commentary that's like gorgeous. This movie is just the eighth grade book report themes. Not particularly well executed. So you get sad whales for about 45 minutes.
And then the final battle.
Which is like an hour. It's like so long.
I actually read a commentary from James Cameron when he says they took out a whole bunch of fighting scenes because he didn't want to be too violent.
James Cameron also said some stupid things about Native Americans. I should have sent this to you beforehand because I'm sure you'd have opinions because you know more about Native Americans than I do.
Yes.
He said like Native Americans, if Native Americans could have seen like the suicide rates among their people now, like if they could have seen that back in the day, maybe they would have fought harder to not be conquered. And everyone was like, what? Because he was talking about the Na'vi fighting back.
If you could see me, I am holding my head.
Yeah.
I'm literally holding my head.
This is what I'm saying. It's like you can, we're almost done talking about the plot, so we'll get into this more, but these problems with like the creator and the writers and stuff like leak into the script, and then we get these problems with this narrative. But anyway,
there's the grand battle, right? So basically, somebody dies who was like a nice character that shouldn't be dying. Right?
I mean, everybody's
very sad.
We can say it, right? We're not. I mean, we spoiled it by now.
It's very predictable.
It's very predictable. It's the oldest son who was the perfect son and the perfect warrior, and he dies saving his siblings. So sad. Everybody's sad and cries. And this is another trope. We're going to reach into our trope jar and pull out a beautiful another trope. It's called, it goes by several different names. Colloquially, we call it womb syndrome, which is when female characters are completely controlled by the fact that they're mothers. Where, like, everything else about their character falls away because they're a mother, and so now they must act. And that happens to Neytiri, who's basically absent from this movie. Her oldest son dies, and suddenly she's like, hold on, now the fight's serious. Not the part about them hunting the giant mystical whales, not the part about the sky people coming and killing other Na'vi, not the part about me being chased from my home, not the part about the fact that these people previously killed Home Tree just like 10 years ago, not the fact that they're mining on my planet and destroying the ecosystem and breaking up, not any of that, but my son died. So this is really now a very serious battle, and I'm going to go in there and give him my all. And she has this, like, this scene when he dies where I know they were trying to be dramatic and sad and whatever, where she's, like, screaming because he's dying. But first of all, we got barely any characterization on this kid, so he's a fake person who's dead on my screen. I'm not that sad. Two, it's just like she's barely been on screen, and you only trot her out when she needs to fight with another woman or be sad that her kid is dead.
Shut down a whole bunch of all these ornithopters shooting the guys through.
After he died.
Before as well, in the very beginning.
She does, you're right. In the very beginning of the battle, she does. Yes, she does that one trick. But it's like, that's it. You know? And it's like, she's a mom, so her whole story has to be about being a mom. She loses all of her, like, having been the chieftain's daughter, all of her seriousness about protecting her people, all of her identity as a Na'vi, all of that's out the window because now she's a mom. Basic.
Yeah, and so anyway, so there's the colonel captures the various children at various points throughout this big fight and is trying to get Jake to come to him to have a final big boss battle.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
And they do have it, and apparently Jake wins. He doesn't dismember the colonel, though. He just kind of chokes him, and the guy sinks to the bottom.
It's very unclear how long it takes Na'vi to drown, because there's a lot of near drownings.
If you know how to breathe.
Right.
So the mother and Tuck get trapped underwater, like in an air packet in a sinking ship.
Right.
And is saved by Kiri and her magical fish.
Yes. So Kiri's magical destiny, which you might have thought would have a narrative purpose, amounts to the fact that she can cast spells now. So she can cast blinding light, and she can cast find, and she can also use a magical...
She can put a little butterfly on her back, and
she
can
use a
underwater.
Magical underwater butterfly, and that magical underwater butterfly gives you air underwater. So there you go. That's her magical destiny, was to save her mother and sister from being trapped in an air pocket in a ship where they just decided to drown. They just said, okay, this is where we drown. Meanwhile, Jake is having the final boss battle with the colonel. Neytiri killed the colonel the first time. She should have been there to kill him. She should have been the one to kill him the second time.
Yeah, I expected that she would kill him.
Yeah.
But that would kill the next Avatar 3. So,
right. Because who actually saves the colonel? Colonel doesn't die.
Colonel is kind of sitting on the bottom of the ocean, and then Spider realizes his dad is down, quote-unquote dad, is down the bottom, and he brings him up to the surface, and he's not dead.
Yeah. Which would have made more sense if my thought on the story had happened, if they had had bonding, if they had bonded, and bonded with their connection with Pandora. And even if you want to have the big final battle, and the colonel can still be like, you know, he's bonded with Pandora, but he can't overcome his hatred for Jake, so he has to have this battle. If Spider and he had bonded in some fashion, Spider saving him would make sense. But Spider saving him makes no sense. None. Am I wrong? Does it make any sense?
Yeah, yeah.
So he lives, and then, I forget
and
where
the ship sinks, and that's the end.
Right? The ship sinks, and then what happens? What's the ending of this figure movie?
They don't go back to the woods, do they?
No, they like are accepted into the tribe or something, right? They're like, you are water people.
The cool thing about the movie, I mean, I found it enjoyable, but it wasn't particularly deep.
The fact that we summarized a 3-hour-and-15 movie in about 40 minutes and didn't miss anything, I think indicates the problem with the movie.
It was visually quite striking. So a lot of the like scenery, this time underwater, with all the animals and plants and stuff. Similarly, like it was in the first movie in the woods, it's very striking. It's kind of borderline beautiful kind of
thing. Oh, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
But like the contrast is, you know, like when they showed the human city, it was like all the dusty and ugly and machines and stuff. And it's like, oh, come on, you know. Then they had some people with sense who came there. You know, all these,
right.
these naive scientists who wanted to do something or other.
I think what you're hitting on, though, is a really important point. So the problem, one of the underlying fundamental problems with the Avatar universe is that all of its characters are stereotypes. All of its characters, including its human characters. Because the military comes in. And they're the military. They're strong. They're tough. They want to mine. They want to beat down the natives, take control, cut the trees. Meh, you know, the capitalists are like, we just want to sell stuff. We don't care about killing the whales. The scientists are like, oh, we're just meek. We're scientists. We just want to study. We don't have anything. Oh, I mean, when we get one of those in this movie, too, the whale scientist, there's this character who I feel like probably has scenes on the cutting room floor.
Right.
He was really interesting. He's like this whale scientist, a marine biologist. A marine xenobiologist who's on Pandora studying these whales, but the only way he can get to these whales is to be on a whaling ship where they're killing the whales. And it's like, I'm interested in his story. Like, that's, like, he was kind of between a rock and a hard place. There's no other way for him to research these whales besides being there when they're being murdered, right? And he has some great lines in there, but it's also very generic. It's like, oh, the scientist, all the scientist does is study. Doesn't have, you know, control over anything or political opinions or try to fight anything or any kind of heroism, nothing like that. The military people fight and are tough. The capitalists want to do anything for the money. Ignoring the fact that, like, in real life, people are so multidimensional, you know, and like you're saying, the people building the city on Pandora, that's a great point. Why would you have to kill the entire forest in a huge area where you're actually creating a sandy desert in the middle of a forested area of Pandora to build a human city? Human cities also need trees and grass.
Well, so I doubt James Cameron would have an answer for this, but remember we read this book called Bios?
Yeah, a long time ago. I liked Bios.
Yeah, we should maybe read it again.
Yeah.
It was about a planet that was essentially the flora and the fauna were lethal to humans.
Right.
So if you got exposed to the air or the bacteria or the animals, you would immediately die.
Right. Yes.
So Pandora has a little bit of that. Like, you know, humans cannot breathe the air. So they have a dome.
Yes. Or something. But the other thing we learned in this movie, which I completely forgot in all of, you know, the wonderful plot that we were just describing, is that the reason humans are building on Pandora is because they're trying to colonize it. They're trying to make it the new Earth because they've irreparably killed Earth and they can't live there anymore. So they're trying to colonize a planet whose atmosphere they cannot breathe. Someone make it make sense.
Well, you know, it's maybe that's the only planet they could find with the atmosphere close enough. So.
It doesn't matter if it's close enough. It's not breathable. I mean, unless the plan is to, like, I mean, maybe this will come up in the movies. Maybe the plan is to completely terraform Pandora and just, like, wipe it out and start a whole new ecosystem, which is, like, if you can do that, then why can't you fix Earth? You know?
Terraform Earth.
Right? Like, if you can terraform Pandora, why can't you fix Earth? You know, if you can have, you know, machine exoskeletons for why can't you make this guy walk? Like, you know, these things are incompatible.
They don't have any unobtainium on Earth, so that's why.
Of course. I forgot about the unobtainium. They need some spice. That's what they need. They need to go to Dune and get some spice. But I think the characters being stereotypical is such a problem. It's such a weakness in both the first movie and the second movie, more so in the second movie, because viewers have become smarter and more savvy to these things because we've seen it before. Nothing.
I mean, it's not just savvy. It's just simply it's just predictable, and it's like,
right.
You know, at least first time around, the novelty of the world was kind of struck you a lot. And here it was just variation. So instead of trees, it's in the underwater.
Now it's an underwater tree, exactly. But like, think about like the plot, like the narrative. What in this movie have we not seen in another movie before? Plot wise, nothing. The visuals, sure.
Visuals, yeah.
Everything else, every other plot point, I've seen women being catty with each other. I've seen a father trying to protect his family. Oh my god, which Jake says as like a voiceover multiple times in the movie. He's like, a father's job is to protect his family. I'm like, you really bringing that toxic masculinity into the future there, Jake. Yeah, great. We love it.
No, I remember at the very end, he said, so what we have learned today is that we're not going to run away anymore. We're going to stand up and fight.
Wasn't that what you were doing, bud?
Why didn't you do it before?
You know? Right. You were doing it with the tree people pretty good. You're doing a pretty good job. The other thing I think about this, I think an underlying problem is, top three underlying problems, is that the world building has not been thought through to its logical conclusion. In a lot of ways. So you have these cool bits and pieces plugging into the trees. That's neat. Big world connection. I'm here for that. I love that kind of science fiction, big brain kind of concept. But then you have the Na'vi. And we know from the way they speak that their connection is sort of, they see it as sort of spiritual. It seems to be an actual like science fiction kind of connection. But they also have a sort of spirituality about it. And they refer to that as the mother, Awa. And it's their god is female, is a female woman god, right? They identify their god as a woman. And yet, all of the Na'vi societies we see are patriarchal.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make any sense. Because the patriarchal societies on Earth developed and are reflected in religions. Or are not reflected in religions for matriarchal societies. Those kind of things develop alongside each other. It doesn't make any sense that, like, they're only god. They don't have, like, a pantheon of gods with, like, lots of options. They don't seem to have, like, different sects of their Awa thing. They're all into Awa. It's Awa all the time. It doesn't make any sense that...
It's like the Force.
Yeah, it's like the Force. But they've gendered it. They've specifically, as a society, have gendered it. And understand also the importance of connection between people, which is related to birth, right? Which, so that, like, that kind of makes sense that they see their god as female because of that. Like, that follows. So then, but then you have male chieftains, you know, in all of the places we see, because Neytiri was the daughter of the last chief.
Right, so the whole idea of a chieftain and a king and stuff, that's a very, very Western idea. So in fact, again, like I told you, I just read this very long book about called Dawn of Everything, which covered a lot of the early society, especially some of the in North America. There was not really that kind of hierarchical organization. So there were maybe like a bunch of elders who might be consulted on some decisions, but very often they included women. They were very, they were much more matriarchal. I guess part of it comes with the idea of owning property. Mm-hmm. Because when you don't have property, inheritance doesn't matter. When you don't have property, then there is no question of inheritance. Mm-hmm. So then those kinds of things are not that important.
Right. And I think in the original, and it's like, it's not that you can't have like a leader of your particular tribe of Na'vi or whoever it is you want to do it. But I just don't think it was thought through to a logical, it wasn't thought through logically. You know, these are, as far as we know, the Na'vi don't have currency. These are not, they're not landed gentry. Right. You know, they're living in like this very communal sort of, you know, socialist utopia.
Well, they're living in their own environment when there is no scarcity. The sea provides or the forest provides.
Right, so, exactly. Mm-hmm. And like their primary threat is the nature around them, not each other. Right. So it doesn't, that kind of structure doesn't make any sense. Like it's so jarring to like have our characters, first of all, to have our main character be like like voiceovering, a father's job is to protect and I will protect and I will, like this doesn't make any sense. Especially like, I get it if that was like when he first got there, but he's been there for like a decade. He's like got married, he's got kids there. Like at a certain point in time, you gotta leave that other stuff behind, man. Like, get over your trauma. Go to therapy. Like, move on. You know, you're not comparing your masculinity to the other Na'vi over here. Like, you're good. These concepts of these like very Western, like you were saying, concepts of masculinity and femininity that are plastered onto the Na'vi, just undermine it and just make it seem thin. Like it's the society appears thinner. You know what I mean? Like it feels.
Yeah. I mean, it's just blue people basically. That happens in a lot of science fiction stories where it's difficult to invent a whole new culture.
Yeah. But I think that's one of the things that this suffers from, because we now, as an audience, expect that, because we have stories like that now. You know, we have things like, you have universes like Star Trek that are so sprawling because they've existed for so long, and you have so many options. You have Star Wars, which is so sprawling. You know, you have all these things that are coming out, and new stories that are coming out, new movies that are coming out, that are so, I mean, with the last one we did, Psalm for the Wild Built. Fascinating. What a fascinating concept of society. And those are just humans on Earth, right? Yeah. Well, not Earth. Sorry, some kind of moon. It wasn't Earth. And, like, that's the kind of thing people are into. And rightly so, because it's new. And that's how you can
get. Yeah, and you're right. It's in some ways, this feels kind of very old.
Right, that's the thing.
Not all dated. The plot is very dated. You know, the visuals are kind of cool, but that's about it.
Yeah. And it didn't seem, I don't know, it's unfortunate because, again, there's these great science fiction concepts. And, like, they just, when you take a dated narrative and loaded up with like cool science fiction concepts, it's still a dated narrative. And it doesn't work with your science fiction concepts. Like the fact that Neytiri's father had been chief and he dies in the first movie and he gives her his like big fancy bow. It's a very important bow that then breaks in this movie. And it means who knows what, nothing. Why wouldn't she take over as leader? You know? If he was so important and she was important to that Na'vi tribe, we know from the first movie she's very important, why wouldn't she take over? I would watch that movie. I would love to watch that movie. You know, and then if Jake is being chased and he's like, look, they're coming after me, I can't stay here. And then maybe the movie's about how he has to leave. Because why did he have to move his whole family? He could have just left himself. But, or maybe it's something about how they have to separate and she stays with them and he's like, whatever. Like, there's like, you know, do something with these characters that isn't just generic.
Well, I'm wondering if what happened was that, you know, James Cameron got kind of fell in love with the world and visual world. And just wanted to show more of it.
I think what happened, if I were to speculate, and I will, because that's my podcast and I can, I would say James Cameron came up with the world and the kind of the ideas for these stories about 2 decades ago and didn't get to produce the one until it came out in 2010 and didn't get to produce this one until over a decade later. And those stories that he came up with worked when he came up with them, but no longer work now.
But even something like Star Wars, like I find Star Wars a little bit kind of silly.
Star Wars is basic too, yeah.
You know, Star Trek is different in the sense that because they travel from planet to planet, they can just upend the whole thing and come up something completely different and new. And it just fits into the universe because, you know, they're in one place. I mean, Star Wars could do something similar, but they don't.
Star Trek also kind of has an origin story of being like having a liberal agenda. I mean, that was kind of the idea. So
woke agenda.
It does. It does have a woke agenda, and that's why we love it. So Star Trek is sort of purposefully pushing those boundaries. You know, they have episodes in all of the Star Treks about different races, different genders, different sexualities, different like whatever it is, different political stuff. You know, immigrants, all kinds of stuff like that. So, but that kind of is baked in because Gene Roddenberry made Star Trek with that purpose. But I mean, that's the kind of thing I think modern viewers are looking for, and not necessarily in a heavy-handed kind of way. You know, I'm not saying you should have the Na'vi chieftain stand up and say, there shall be universal health care for everyone. You know, like, it's not like that. But give me a more complicated story. They had the perfect character for that in this with Kiri, the magical destiny child. I'm all for you having a character who has a magical destiny. Science fiction magic is included. She has some kind of magical destiny. If you're going to include it, you have to include it in this movie. You can't include it like a quarter of the way in this movie and then promise me I'm getting 4 more movies and it'll happen then. You know, because it's like they obviously set it up, but they set up a bunch of stuff in this movie that didn't actually come to fruition. It's like at some point you have to tell me the story.
Yeah, I think probably has problems with cutting things out. Again, like I said, the one part I read about what he was saying is that there were lots of fighting, violent scenes where he decided to just cut them out.
Good. We didn't need them. We needed more like, we needed like a revision of the script. Hire one person who speaks this language and have them revise your script. Like, you don't need more visuals of the whale dying. I get it. Like, it's bad. I don't want to see it either. It's like there's some, when you're going to show violence on screen, and this comes up a lot with modern shows like Game of Thrones, House of the Dragon, that kind of stuff. You're going to show me violence on screen. You better have a damn good reason to do it. Because it's not pleasant. People, the vast majority of people don't like to watch it. So if you're going to be doing it, it better have a point. And I don't know, what was the point of killing the whale? The sky people are bad? Did we not know that already?
Well, I guess they had to have something why they're there still. Because they didn't mention Unobtainium, so they had to. How come all these fancy substances exist only on Pandora?
That at least I can buy. That it's a magical science fiction planet, and there's magical new elements that we don't have on Earth, and therefore there's that. Like, I can get that science fiction magic. But, like, killing the whale, you can tell me you killed a whale without showing me. You can imply you killed a whale without showing me. Right. You know, it's kind of like in the first movie, there was a very effective violent scene when they destroy Home Tree, I think it is, the big tree where all the Na'vi live, to get to the Unobtainium underneath. It was very effective because you think the Na'vi are going to save Hometree. Everyone's fighting. The Na'vi are all fighting back. They're trying to defend it, whatever. And then they don't, because the humans are just so much more powerful. And it's terrifying. It's a sad scene. It's depressing. You've got Neytiri, like, screaming and crying. Her father's dying. Hometree's falling down. Their whole society's being destroyed. And it's horrifying, but in the correct way. It's like, I needed to see that to understand this danger, to understand the impact on this character, to get your themes in your narrative. You could cut out the whale hunt from this movie. Nothing changes.
Well, I mean, in the first movie, the final battle was like the all of the Earth's army that was there came to fight, right?
That was like the spirit tree, yeah.
Yeah, and this one was just one whaling ship.
Yeah, you're right. We really downgraded. No, I mean, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. It really is a much smaller scale when you think about it. Unless, like, I guess I was talking to you about this right afterwards. I think one of the problems this particular movie had, was that it couldn't decide who it was about. Because it wanted to be about the whole family, except Neytiri. It didn't want to be about Neytiri. It wanted to be about the whole family. But in this kind of situation, I think you either have to have a movie that's about the parents who now have children, or it's about the children who are the children of those parents you know. You gotta focus somewhere. You gotta give me some kind of main character something. Because who's the main character?
Well, Jake is kind of the focus of the thing, but I mean, he's kind of...
He's not in half the movie. There's a solid hour of screen time where he's not on screen.
That's true, where the kids are.
Where the kids are. You know, so it's like... That's why I thought Kiri was going to be our... And it's like, look, if you're going to do 5 movies, you got four kids. Give me a movie per kid. Make it work. Well, now there's only 3. So this one could have been about the oldest son, you know, and then our main character dies at the end. That could have been dramatic, and then I would have cared. You know, he sacrifices himself for something, then it would have mattered. But it's like the narrative structure of it is so lost that you can't tell... I don't want to say you can't tell a story with this many characters, because I think in the hands of better writers, you probably can. Yeah. But you can't do it this way. There's also just stuff that, like, random complaints, voiceovers. What are we, in the 90s? We don't do that anymore. We don't do introductions with voiceovers. Like, they don't even do that in Disney animated movies anymore. So, I'm like, if you have to start your 3-hour and 15-minute movie by... having your character summarize what's been happening for the past 10 years in a voiceover while his kids frolic in the forest and look happy and everything is great, put that first draft down, wait a few months, come back to it. Because what a terrible way to start a movie. The first, like, 15, 20 minutes is just this, like, awful, like, blah. It's boring.
It wasn't that long, but there were some really silly things, like, where they're posing for pictures.
Yeah. Right? And I'm like, oh, cameras? No, this looks so idyllic and wonderful. I hope nothing happens to disturb this wonderfulness. And he's like voiceovering about happiness. He's like, happiness is where you find it. And happiness is this. And I'm like, Jake, what? What, buddy? I don't know. Let me think.
All right, so do you recommend that people should go see this movie or not?
So I do. I do think you should go see it. Because, not because it's good, because it's not. But so that you can get an understanding of why it's not good.
Well, I think you also see it because it's visually very...
It's very pretty. It's very pretty. I think that is worth it. I mean, the money that they spent on the graphics and the design was
well spent. It's borderline Disney, you know.
You know what I thought was really good, actually, in this movie? And I meant to tell you this. The designs of the Earth ships and the Earth technology I thought was really cool. Like, they have a couple shots of the ships arriving... And like the way, like I'm always interested in the way they design future human ships, and I thought that was very well done. Though then they do stupid, they always ruin it. Do you remember the scene in the beginning where the Earth ships arrive and they're landing, and as they're like they're coming to land, and the only way in the future that we can get ships to land on a planet is for a giant ball of fire to come out of the bottom of the ship as it lands. That's the only way. And it burns up all the whole forest. And it clears the area. That must be where they build a city. So they land, and it's just like, they're like, oh no, the fire. And Jake's like, they're landing. And I'm like, is this the only way we can land? How do we land ships on Earth? Do we just not land ships on Earth? Like, We haven't figured out interstellar space travel, but not like how to land without fire. Exactly. And
rockets kind of do land that way, so they do burn stuff.
They land that way now in 2022. This is in the distant future with avatars and capsules and who knows what kind of time dilation happening.
Something you said made me think of this. So you said, you know, it's like an old plot kind of drafted onto a brand new movie. Mm-hmm. If we do Tempest and Forbidden Planet, mm-hmm. it would be an old plot drafted onto a more recent movie. Mm-hmm. It might be interesting to see how that works out.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's impossible. I think there are some plots that are, I mean, there's tons of rehashing, particularly in science fiction. And there are some plots that maintain levels of interest and maintain levels of relevancy. But there are some that don't. You know, I think like Disney's making all these live action remakes of various movies. They're not remaking a live action Pocahontas. I don't think they can. I think if they try to, they'd have a really rough time because everybody knows that the Pocahontas Disney movie is not what happened in real life and has a lot of problems. And Avatar, the first one, is like Pocahontas. So it's like, oh, you can go and like befriend the natives and like become one of them. And that's good. Like, ugh, is it? The other thing is I don't have an opinion on this, but I don't feel like I'm educated enough to have an opinion on this. But I would love to read, and you sent me an article to read, and I didn't read the whole thing, so I don't know if they covered it in there. I would love to read someone's analysis of the hairstyles in this movie, because I feel like they bother me. It bothers me that the sexy blue people have dreads or have locks. It bothers me that the sexy blue natives that we found have braids. It concerns me. Again, it's generic. It's part of that, like, you know, James Cameron and his writers said, how do we make people look native? And their answer was to give them locks and braids. So that concern, that's a very Western thing to do. And it doesn't feel great. I just don't feel, I'm not educated enough to like do a full analysis of that, but I would love to read somebody doing an analysis of that. It's concerning.
It didn't bother me at all.
It bothered me in the first movie too. It was something I noticed in the first movie, but more so here. But yeah, go see it. Cause it's pretty.
It's fun, but it's besides the depth of the water, there isn't much of depth in it.
The deepest part of this movie is the ocean. It's true, though.
All right, let's wrap up.
Okay, do we know what we're going to do next?
Well, we were talking about doing Tempest and the Forbidden Planet, so why don't we do that?
Yes, that is what we should do. Yes, I agree. And I'm going to plug my other podcasts while we're here, because the one's happening. So if anyone's interested in analysis of House of the Dragon, check out Unabashed Book Snobbery wherever you get your podcasts. We are covering each episode one a week. I'm doing it with Kylie and Julia, who I did the Game of Thrones podcast with back in the day. They haven't seen the show House of the Dragon. I have, so it's been very fun to get their reactions, and we like it. It's a good show. And check out my other podcast, Gaze, GAZE. It's on SoundCloud and Spotify. That's with my friend Jen, who's a lawyer, and another lawyer, and we watch various gay media and analyze it. I think we just did the Fear Street trilogy. We did A League of Their Own. We did Do Revenge. And we've done like 10 or so episodes of that. And that's on SoundCloud and Spotify. Okay, thanks everyone for joining us at History in Reverse. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.